Good morning, good morning, good morning. How is everyone? Good morning. Oh, that didn't sound too good. How is everyone? All right, that's much better. You're here, you made it, you're alive, you're healthy, it's great, it's wonderful. And welcome to another Pennsylvania Conference for Women, where we celebrate ourselves. My name is Celeste Warren, and I am the Chief Global Diversity and Inclusion Officer at Merck. And we are in the house. And I want to welcome you to this working session. It is entitled Finding and Engaging Male Allies. And we have a wonderful thought leader and panel. I want to just say for just a second that we are so happy. Merck is one of the sponsors, one of the great companies that has sponsored this event, because our values are the same when it comes to women, and not just looking at women as a group, as a totality, but women, women of color, women with disabilities, women in the LGBTQ community, women who are veterans, all of us together celebrating ourselves. And that's what we're here to do today, at this time. So I'm going to introduce our thought leader and moderator for the panel, and then he is going to introduce the rest of the panelists. Joining us on stage is David G. Smith. He is the co-author of Athena Rising, How and Why Men Should Mentor Women, and associate professor of sociology in the Department of National Security Affairs at the United States Naval War College. So he brings a lot of energy. I was talking with him over the last half hour about his experiences without saying, what do you know about this? But he knows a lot. He's done a lot of research. And so without any further ado, please sit back and enjoy, and we will have audience Q&A at the end. Thank you.
All right. Well, good morning, and thanks, Celeste, for that great introduction, and I'm not sure that I can live up to that, but what I think I know from people like you, right, all of you out there, because, again, knowledge that we attain and what I have, we've amassed on this topic really comes from senior leaders across the board, both from our book, Athena Rising, and our new book, I'll talk a little bit more about around male allies, but it comes from senior women and your experiences, and so I'm going to try not to mansplain that to you, but I'm going to talk about it in terms of your experiences out there. But first, what I'd like to do before we get on to this great panel, and I'm really excited about, we have a rock star panel up here today of industry leaders out there and their experiences, and I really want to learn more from them. But I want to contextualize a little bit of this for them to kind of set this up and as what we know about allyship and why, in particular, this is critical. If we're looking to solve a lot of the gender inequities first, and amongst many of the other systemic inequalities in our workplaces out there. But it's interesting, despite a lot of the great work and focus on gender initiatives, much like a conference like this, that there's still a lot of harmful practices and inequities in the workplace that are not only harmful to women, as you all well know, but also to businesses and to men, right? And so that is why this is one of the key aspects that I want to make sure that we walk away from here today is that first and foremost, that we can't make this a women's issue. All right, this is not a women's issue. This is a leadership issue. This is a business issue, which includes men. And that's why it's important that we have male allies out there to do this. Unfortunately, there's a large, broad disconnect out there. And you see this in research in a variety of different ways. And it comes up in terms of things like when we ask men about, how much bias and discrimination do women face in the workplace? Are they have the same opportunities to advance in the workplace? Do they get paid the same as men in the workplace? And men generally agree that is true. The majority agree those are things that, nope, the bias doesn't exist, discrimination's not there, women are paid equally and they have just as much opportunity as men. And then when we ask you, the women out there, we get a very different answer, right? That no, that's not the case. We still face bias in a lot of ways. There's a lot of discrimination and certainly are not paid the same as the men in the workplace. So we got a disconnect out there, and we've got to figure out how do we get beyond that disconnect? How do we fill the gap? One of the reasons that it's it's hard to fix this problem, if we can just call it just a broad problem for a minute, is that it's hard to fix what you can't see. And I always love to use the metaphor, and we used this earlier in a talk that I did with Bristol Myers Squibb this morning, that it's like fish in the ocean, right? So we're swimming along, and everybody's happy, and especially the men are warm and happy and swimming along in the ocean. And there are other fish in the ocean that are not as happy. They actually find the water to be very toxic, right? And these are, and the women in particular, and women of color, and LGBTQ women out there, find it to be very toxic. But as a guy, if I'm swimming along and I just don't see it, right, it's hard to understand the problem. It's hard to fix of something that you can't see, despite the fact that in many ways there's lots of great evidence, research, events like these that are bringing it to the forefront. Even worse is the challenge around, so in this post-Me Too workplace that we're out there today, and the research again showing that male managers are less comfortable, right, of socializing, of mentoring, of working with women in the workplace, and even in the corporate world, senior leaders out there, the same thing. Again, not as likely or not as comfortable to spend time with junior women in a variety of hosts of settings out there. So one of the things I think we as men we have to do is come back and remember that for our work sisters out there, or our sisters in arms, as we would call you in the military, that what Me Too was really about, and hit a reset here for just a minute and say that, remember that Me Too was about women asking and demanding to be able to come to work and not be harassed or assaulted. I think it's a really low bar. We can get past that, right? And that as guys, one of the things that we continue to hear and can continue to advance this idea, these false narratives around there, that somehow women have, in the post-Me Too world, one, they've caused this. No, they didn't. We did, right? There were guys who were the perpetrators doing these things. But somehow women are now scary or dangerous in some way out there, and we should fear women. And, you know, we even in our new book, we talk about this fact that we've got to get over our gynophobia. Abnormal fear of women, it's a thing. So put that down in your list. Gynophobia, guys, got to get over that, right? And begin to acknowledge it, right? And I think the fact that there's also this false narrative out there, and we really got to push back on this one, that women are going to make false harassment claims against us. And I'm sorry, the evidence does not support that. Sorry, not sorry, right? The evidence does not support that, and we've got to push back. Thank you. So here's the thing. So for the guys in the audience and for the women in the audience, for the men that you work with and live with and are associated with, most of us are well-meaning, well-intentioned dudes, much like me, who are very imperfect. And, you know, we're trying to do the right thing for the most part. I mean, yes, there are some perpetrators and serial harassers out there. And, you know, they're a small number, but most of us are trying to get it right. But sometimes we're going to get it wrong, and we're going to step in it, and I do too, right? And I can give you a laundry list of stories, and we just don't have enough weeks in the month to get through all the stories out there of ways that happens. But just start with people have good intentions, and then we can move on from there. By the way, you know, I always remind guys that you're probably much more likely to get struck by lightning than you are to come up on a false sexual harassment claim at work, so just watch out for the lightning out there. So what's it mean to be a male ally? Because we're going to talk about male allies today, and how do we find them, and how do we get them involved in the work that we're trying to accomplish here today. And my co-author, Brad Johnson, and I just finished our research for our new book around men and women as allies and how we partner together to change the workplace. And I'm going to give you a little bit of a snapshot of what that looks like. And so the two key factors that we come up with in how we define allyship broadly, and oh, by the way, you know, we've culturally appropriated this term from the LGBTQ community, right? This is where allyship started. But men, in particular, if we think about gender as allies out there, two things. One, there's an individual piece that we have to hold ourselves individually accountable for how we show up at work, right? The personal relationships, the collaborative, supportive relationships we have with the women that we work with is one. And two is the public part, right? You don't get to just hold yourself accountable, but you got to walk the talk. So just because you can talk a good game, you got to be out there publicly doing it, right? And so when there's something to confront or to call out or to advocate for, right, we need to be doing those things at the same time. And so there's both a a part that we have to individually hold ourselves accountable for, as well as driving the systemic change in the workplace. And that's how we have to partner up to do this together. So the walking the talk requires a motivation. And certainly as we think about allyship and being kind of a journey out there, we know that we kind of move along the way and we're all in different places. And I think that'll come up here today in a few of the conversations we have, that it's got to start with a motivation. And what we found in our work was that there were three kind of categories of motivation. One is the business case, which is a good one. That, again, we understand that more gender diverse organizations out there across leadership, hey, they make better decisions, they're more profitable, they're more innovative, more creative, right? The evidence continues to pile up there. And sometimes men just want to engage in it because they want to learn to be better leaders, right? And be better at their job and taking care of their people. The other might be more of a character side of it, and this is how we think about altruism or social justice, and you just kind of have that burning cause in you of why you do this work. But one of the key pieces is a personal connection. This is the personal case, and we find that most men who engage in being male allies, they have a story to tell about, might have been an important woman in their life at home, it might have been an important female colleague at work, it might have been a female mentor, somebody they've worked with, something they've seen that gets in touch with their sense of fairness and justice, right? And that's what motivates us to do this kind of work and get involved and say, hey, how can I help? How can I be better? How can I learn more about this? And it does. It takes that developing awareness piece. And part of an environment like this, at a conference like this, is a great place for male allies to be. And I, again, applaud the men in the room here, that hopefully you're doing a lot of great listening, right? Listening without the intent to fix anything or making assumptions or that you're going to jump in and rescue the day. You don't need to do that. We just need to listen and learn here and show a little humility as we go through this. I would also tell you that, like I said before, we're going to make mistakes and we're going to learn along the way, and that we all need to give each other a little bit of credit for that and give ourselves a break once in a while when we get it wrong. And for the men out there, that understanding that sometimes the fear of getting it wrong is what makes us hesitant to engage in this work. And we certainly found that in our first book, Athena Rising, about why men avoided or were reluctant to engage in professional mentoring and sponsoring relationships in the workplace, that host of reasons around fear and anxiety and perceptions and what people might think or might say. And right, so we have to learn how to get beyond some of those out there in particular. Part of that is getting beyond the discomfort and the fact that a lot of guys say, you know, I want to help, but I don't know, engaging in this conversation, how do I do it? It makes me really uncomfortable. A lot of the guys here probably figured that out when they walked through the door this morning and they walked into a sea of 10,000 women and they were one of the 10 guys here. And we were like, this feels a little different. Hey, where's the men's room, by the way? You know, the first question you get asked when you come here for the guys in there in particular. The other part of this, and I want to get going into the conversation we're going to have here, but is as the individual part of this is we have to hold ourselves accountable for our own language and behavior. And as allies, we with our female colleagues, we need to make sure that they understand that not only is it okay, but we would really like you to correct us. We'd like the feedback. It's a gift. And when we get that gift, that care of somebody giving us that feedback, we need to be ready to respond in an appropriate way. And I think this is another skill set that as male allies, we have to think about how do we do that. And you could start by just saying thank you. I'm working on that, and I really appreciate that feedback. That's helpful for me today, and I'm going to take that back and think about that and figure out what am I going to do better next time so I can be better out there. So it is a gift out there. But we also have to hold others accountable, right? So this is the public part. And that goes from an advocacy perspective to a confronting other men, which can be kind of challenging and scary in its own right. And when we do confront other men and we call somebody out, that we have to do it in a caring way. But at the same time, you know, recognize that, you know, they're trying to do their best, but when you call a guy out, you can't call him out and go, hey, it's not okay because Romy's here. We don't want to say that in front of Romy. Not cool.
That's happened.
Yeah, right? And I'm sure lots of women have had that experience. Not cool, not an ally, right? Ally behavior is you got to own it. Sorry, it's hard. And you got to own it, and it's got to be yours. And it's like, nope, that's offensive to me, and it's not right, and here's why. And we got to be ready to have that conversation and how we're going to do that. The last part, I think, is as we get beyond the individual is to the organizational level and accountability. And how do we hold our leaders and our organizations accountable for doing the right things as allies there? And so thinking about, do we have policies that are related to, hey, we're not gonna sit on or participate in or support non-diverse panels? Mantles, right? We're not going to participate in those. And does your CEO have a written formal policy with that? Or that when we go out to hire, who's on the team? Who's on the recruiting team that goes out to hire? Is it all a bunch of white men? Because again, that's the first face that the talent that you're recruiting is going to see. And we have to think about that. And the same thing when you come back in to the organization, the hiring committee, what does that look like? When you walk down the most important public places of your organization, what do the pictures look like? We're not very good at it in my organization. In the military, we tend to, you walk down in public places and you see lots of pictures of old white guys. There's a lot of it out there and we have work to do. But a lot of places, we have a lot of work to do out there. And then on the flip side, we got to advocate for policies, even if it doesn't necessarily apply personally to us. So you may not have kids, but you need to be advocating for parental leave and family leave programs. And you may not need flex time, but you need to be advocating for those things because, again, it helps others, right? And this is the ally. How do I show up to help others in my organization and make them more effective and thrive at work out there? Returning moms, we need returnships, right? Things like that. It doesn't apply to me personally, but it does to people I work with, and it's important to them. So we have to get past that. The last piece on accountability is, are we holding our managers and our leaders accountable in terms of the diversity and inclusion outcomes we're looking for? And Celeste and I were having this conversation earlier about how important that is to integrate that into our business outcomes and not make the human resources officer or your CLO responsible for that. No, the frontline business managers have to integrate that into who they are. And oh, by the way, they've also got to figure out how to talk about this in a way that shows they understand and the purpose of it and be very transparent about why they're doing it. The last thing I'm going to leave you with, and we're going to talk here, is that, guys, to be good allies, it's not just at work. It's at home. And it actually starts at home. We have got to show up as equal partners, 50-50, at home first. Do the dishes. Take the kids to childcare. Take them to the doctor. And it's not just the physical labor, right, of the doing these things. It's also the emotional labor. It's the planning the vacations. It's the keeping track of the birthdays and the various things that we have to do in the household, right, that takes up cognitive time, right, in our minds. And, again, if we're going to balance, we got to truly balance. If you don't know how you're doing, ask. Ask for your audit at home, right? How am I doing? And when she tells you, don't argue with her. Thank you. First, and second, now I got some work to do. I got to go back and fix my program here a little bit and get on board with it. Because if we don't fix it at home, guess what? We can't do it in the workplace. And it's also so, so important for our kids. So for those of you with kids, we're role modeling for them. And oh, by the way, dads, if you have daughters like I did, it's really important to their career outcomes. The research shows that if you're an equal partner at home and your daughter is seeing that as she grows up, she has better chances of reaching her career aspirations and being persistent in achieving those. Oh, by the way, better, higher self-esteem, self-confidence, and autonomy too. So lots of great research out there to show you, don't do it for yourself, do it for your kids. Right, and do it for your spouse. So, with that, I want to stop because I do want to. We have a great panel here, and I want to introduce our panelists, and we're going to get right into it, and then we're going to go into some Q&A with you to see what's on your mind and the questions that you have for these experts. So, first we have Romy Newman, and Romy is the co-founder and president of Fairy God Boss. And if you haven't heard about Fairy God Boss, I encourage you to get out there and look it up and see all the great work that they're doing out there to support and advance women in business. And then we have Miriam Kaderi. Miriam's on the U.S. leadership team and the legal senior management team with AstraZeneca. And really, there we go. Well, AstraZeneca in the house, yes.
AstraZeneca's
all
in the house.
Right. And on the end, we have Michelle Nunn, who is the CEO and president of USA Care. So excited to hear her thoughts on this today as well. So, let's get going here. So, Romy, I want to start with you, and I know you've been doing some great research at Fairy God Boss and some proprietary research in particular on male allies. So can you tell us a little bit about some of the results that you found?
Yes, I want to talk about that, but before I do, I actually want to cite a third-party research statistic because I think it's so important for setting the stage for all of these conversations. And this is out of the World Economic Forum. They have found that at our current pace of progress, we are over 200 years from achieving gender parity in the workplace. Right? That is really depressing, and it's unacceptable. And so when we come together in a forum like this, we need to feel urgency, and we need to feel, you know, we need to feel look for radical solutions. And one thing I can tell you, and why this panel is so important, is we are not going to radically accelerate that timeline in the way that it needs to be working alone as women. We need male allies. And so it's so important that we find ways to engage them and have them join in this cause and have them do it. You talked about the motivations. It's we need them to do it for reasons that are genuine to them, not just because it looks good cosmetically or it was a nice thing to do, but because it really will make a difference to them personally. So that's my come down from the soapbox for a sec. But so, but this is what I stay up at night thinking about. And so when we did some research with male allies, and of our survey pool, 88% of the men said they want to be male allies, which is wonderful. And of those 88%, 56% said, we don't know how. They just don't know how. And so I think the way that we engage the men we work with has to change dramatically. I think we have to have much more candid, courageous conversations. I think we have to say, look, this is an issue that really matters to me. Look, there's tons of research that says our team will perform better if we are more gender diverse. There's also increasingly greater rewards for men who behave as male allies in the workplace. If male managers have gender diverse teams, increasingly, and diverse of all kinds teams, they're rewarded for it. So when we talk to men about allyship, we have to do collaborative problem solving. We have to say, hey, there is gender imbalance here. I see it here and here. It's not a problem for me and her. It's a problem for this company. Come be a hero with me, and let's solve it together.
All right. So where do we start then? As you think about the people in your research and your own experience in the corporate world, do we start with the junior guys? Do we start with the senior men? Is it kind of a grassroots or a senior or leadership?
No, I would certainly say senior. I mean, I think, first of all, the unspoken challenge of gender diversity progress is that women are not represented as well at the leadership ranks. So we just don't have the clout to make transformation in the way that we want to. So we have to appeal to the clout. And also, junior members of an organization model themselves after senior people. So if senior men really take up the mantle of allyship, it will make a huge difference. And there are many examples of this. And I have personally been the beneficiary of senior leaders who've really been an ally to me in my career. But I think the more that successful senior male leaders model and embrace and invest in allyship, the better the outcome will be for the whole organization.
One last follow-up. I love that 88% of men wanted to be a male ally or engaged in that way, but not, I mean, a lot of them not sure, but it begs the question, what about that other 12% out there?
Right. Well, credit for being honest, right? But I think a little bit, though, it's, look, there are a ton of problems in this world. There are a ton of challenges in this world. And even with good intentions, not everybody has a ton of bandwidth, right? So I think it goes to how do we catalyze men, whether they self-proclaim as male allies or not, how do we catalyze them to involve them in this cause what is their personal motivation going to be? Why is it worth, you know, if they're working an 80-hour week, why is it worth it for them to spend the 81st or 82nd hour on this issue?
Great question. All right, let's move on. Miriam, so in your experience, what do you think prevents men from taking action? Because, I mean, at the end of the day, it's one thing, right, as we heard here with Romy, that men profess this need or desire, okay, yeah, I want to be a male ally, but what's preventing them from taking action? And do you have any thoughts on specific strategies that we could use to help engage them in that?
Sure. So first, a real privilege to be with all of you today. I said to somebody this morning, this is my first time coming to the Women's Conference, and almost every year I'm traveling during this week, and it's incredible to see just the support around the room. So really humbling to be here. But to answer your question directly, I'm going to share a vulnerable story in a minute because I think it might hopefully help. One of the first kind of management jobs I had in my career, and it wasn't a true management job, but I managed a small team of people. And on my team were five individuals, one of whom was a guy, two of whom were incredible women. I mean, super talented beyond anyone's imagination. And I had the guy who was talented but relatively new in his career, like he was still learning and growing, constantly at my doorstep, like, I want this, I want that, I want this opportunity. And I kept waiting for the two women to come. Like, surely they're going to get here any day now. And as a woman, I'm embarrassed to say I had to think about, I'm going to have to mentor and coach these two women in a very different way than this guy. And I'm a woman saying that and thinking that, right? It's kind of embarrassing for me to admit that now in my career, you know, 30 years later. But I did think that because of the way I grew up. It wasn't something I had to think about. And I share that because I don't think it's that the vast majority of men don't want to be allies. It's that they don't know that they have to be.
Yeah.
And they don't know, even if they know they have to be, they don't at all know how to do it. And we can sit around and blame them for that, or we can teach them how to, right? We can teach them how in our homes. We can teach them how in our communities. We can teach them how in our workplaces. And I'll talk to the unicorn men in a second, but for the women in the room who outnumber you today, I guess what I would say is all of you sit in places in your world where you have a voice, right? Maybe you're not a senior leader in your company, but maybe you're a senior leader in, you know, the PTA or in the schools that you volunteer in, or maybe you have activities that you're involved in other places, or better yet, maybe you are, you know, in a senior position in the organization that you work in, and you really do have an obligation, I don't think to chastise or to, you know, constantly point out issues in a negative way, but to ask questions. So anybody who knows me, I spend a lot of time asking questions, and oftentimes in those questions there are, well, why do you assume that so-and-so wouldn't want that role because they just had a baby, for example? It doesn't come from a bad place. It comes from we don't want to burden someone. But if you turn the question around and make the person, the unicorn in front of you, think, boy, does it go somewhere. So I do think we have a little bit of an obligation to kind of help educate a little bit. I know I needed to be educated, and I was a woman, so I can't even imagine if you're a guy thinking about, gosh, I keep hearing about allyship, but what do I do? So I think that's really the fundamental issue.
It's interesting, you know, in talking to men about important women in their family life, right? And we talk about gender inequities, and they're all about allyship when I talk to them about that. But then when it comes to they get to work, being that public ally, not so much. Is there something about that that we can tap into to maybe help energize and engage men a little bit more as allies?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know we're 200 years away, and that figure is just depressing to me beyond belief. But I actually think we're closer than 200, but probably more than a decade, because we're in a period of time right now where, at least in the community I live in, you have more people with double working families. You have more young men and young women who are being raised watching their mothers go to work and watching their fathers, in many cases, have to step it up. I think of myself as a pretty young person, but I still had a mom who worked at home. And I didn't really have that kind of figure in my life. And I'm not, you know, it's not like I grew up in the 40s or 50s, right? So I do think we have this period where the opportunity is kind of ripe. I think the biggest disservice we do as women is that we don't talk about it, right? Like, I spend a lot of time saying, this isn't easy, right? Like, it's not easy, quote, balancing it or, quote, having it all. I don't balance it, and I don't have it all, full stop, right? But here's some tricks that I've used or things that I've done. And I do think, Dave, to your point of, you know, what do we do, right? I think what we do is we talk about it. I think the men need to talk about kind of the challenges that they're dealing with their families or with their parents or with people at work. And I think the women have to also talk about what they need to do to kind of make the family life work. It's incremental. Like, I don't think there's going to be a banner that comes up that makes it all kind of go away. But I do think with this next generation, I was talking to Celeste before we started, you know, my kids have no concept of, like, when I told them I'm going to a women's conference today, they literally said, well, why? Like, why do you need to go to a women's conference, right? And that's their mindset. And boy, is that great that it is, and can we keep it that way? Because if we can get that group moving, I think we'll see some radical change.
You should have heard what my kids said when I said that.
Oh, what did they say? Good.
I wanted to ask you one more question about one of the comments you made about asking, right? As we do this learning part, right, there's got to be an ask in there. But I think one of the challenges here is that one of my concerns as I look at this is that I feel like we're placing some burden back on women, on you, right, to educate us as the men. And it's like, well, wait a minute. If we're going to be gender partners here together, we're going to be allies together, then we need to meet you halfway on that. So any thoughts on how we go, how do we meet halfway? I mean, do the men in the audience, do we have a responsibility to self-educate, is it okay for me to always ask you, so what was your experience in work? You know, because I mean, if all the guys start asking you that, you're not going to have time to do your job if you have to educate everybody.
Yeah, well, first of all, there's a lot of women in the room who can help educate. I don't think I'm the only one, right? Is it fair that we have to help educate? No. Should we have to? No. But if you want change of any kind, you have to invest a little bit in it. Right, that's just my own personal view. People may disagree, but I will also say for the unicorns in the room who are either here today or somewhere else in the community talking or thinking about this, I do think it's okay to ask the questions. Like I don't know of a single woman who doesn't want to share or who doesn't want to talk about it. I think sometimes women, you know, I was raised during a period of time when it was like we're the same. You know, you can do anything a guy can do. And the reality is we're different and it should be celebrated. Like it's okay that we're different. And so I think we have a little bit of work to get past that, you know, everybody's the same kind of thing, at least that I grew up with. And maybe that was just, you know, where I grew up. But I think it's okay to be a little bit burdened. I'm okay being a little bit burdened. And spending a little extra time in my 82nd hour of the day to teach somebody or to help them understand. Because the fact that they care is the first step, right?
Would you like me to ask though?
I don't know that every person's different. I'm a direct person, so you can just kind of, you don't need to ask.
I also think that this progress will benefit from a real sea change that's happening in the workplace, right? When I started in the workplace, which I'm embarrassed to say how long ago it was, I had a boss who just said what everybody did, right? And no one cared if I felt comfortable about it at all. Now the conversation in the workplace is so different. We realize that there are so many different kinds of people in the workplace, different backgrounds, different kinds of education, different work styles. And so to make that new workplace work for us, there has to be open acknowledgement of the differences and discussion around them. And they can come from either side, but I think that we're in a moment of transition where it used to be like, don't bring it. Oh, you're the only woman on this team of eight? Don't bring it up. Versus, let's like, we talk about every elephant in the room, and I think every working conversation should start with, hey, what's your work style? What's your work style? And it will just lead to better work.
Thank you. Well, I want to bring Michelle into the conversation here. And, you know, just so impressed with the work that your organization, CARE, does and confronting. If you haven't, again, look at the all across the world, the work that they're doing, confronting the challenges and the obstacles that are put in front of women and girls all the time out there. But what is it that you've learned along the way as you look at this, how men are convinced that they can partner with women in overcoming those things, and not just overcoming the challenges, but removing the barriers and supporting and advocating for women?
Yeah, so first of all, maybe just a word about CARE, because CARE started right after World War II, and how many of you all know the CARE package? Any CARE package, you send a CARE package, right? So that actually came from the organization CARE, who had a small group of Americans who said, we're not going to let people who are suffering from starvation in post-World War II Europe go without connecting and giving solidarity. And so within a few months of the conceptualization of a CARE package, they delivered 20,000 CARE packages and over time 100 million CARE packages. So CARE now works in 93-plus countries, and our goal is actually to defeat poverty. And what we've learned over the last almost 75 years is that you can't defeat poverty unless women are equal to men. Yeah. Right? There's no way that that happens. Because it's just, you know, latent potential in the world not being tapped, not being utilized. And there's studies that show that if we had true gender equality, but between now and 2025, we could add over $15 trillion to the GDP. Some estimates, $25 trillion. So that's a little bit of CARE's sort of piece of this. We have a huge number of projects that we do around the world, but just to give you an example of the kinds of things that we do that I think are illustrative of this kind of allyship is we try and make visible these inequities. And so I was talking in an earlier session, one of the exercises we do is we have group savings groups that include women. Often then we pull in their husbands and we talk to them about household duties and who does the work. And we literally have a chart where the men get together and they create a 24-hour chart and the women get together over here. And you know what happens is that the men see, oh my gosh, the women are working sometimes 35 hours more per week than the men. And all of a sudden, they start to see it in a new way. And so I think that's the first lesson is, how do you make visible some of these inequities? And how do you bring people into that conversation? The second thing is you invite people into being an ally and to being a part of the solution. And so one of the interesting examples that I have is of a man named Fidel in Rwanda. And Fidel had three daughters. He was poor, disempowered, felt hopeless, and he beat his wife regularly. He went to a CARE group. He started the savings group. And one of the exercises that they did was they talked about gender. And a simple thing that he learned is it's actually the man that controls the chromosome and determines gender of your children. So he had been beating his wife, blaming her for producing three daughters, and he realized that this was about me. And not only was that just a trigger for him, but also a broader sense of an understanding of the inequities in his own household. And so he is now, you know, taking the water pails and helping his wife. And he describes literally his description of the progress they've made is instead of him going out and getting a drink if he has some extra time and money, he walks hand in hand with his wife to the local village square and has a beer together. So and he's become an advocate against domestic violence. So not only has he been given a opportunity to see the inequities, but he's also been given an invitation to participate as a part of the change.
That's great. In many ways, it sounds like you're asking men to acknowledge their privilege in a lot of different ways, right? And there is a lot of privilege in that. But it's also that privilege comes from a lot of power and influence, too. So I'm having to share my power and influence, right? And so how do we get men to do that, right? How do we talk about that in a way that they're going to respond to like a Fidel, for example? Yeah.
Well, I think one of the things that that I see is, so CARE has over 7 million people that are a part of these small savings groups, and largely women, but maybe 20 or 30% men. And when I go and sit in these savings groups where women are saving and then lending each other money to start small businesses and then bringing that income back to their household, inevitably, one woman will stand up. We work in 50 different countries, but I've never been in a circle where this didn't happen, and say, you know, my husband didn't want me to come to this at the beginning. And she said, and now he says, it's time for your village savings and loan group. You need to go. And often the husbands start groups, but what they see is, first of all, the women are bringing in income. They're lifting up the capacity of the family to deal with and support the needs that the family's facing, whether it's education or food or shelter. And the men see not that they're losing privilege as much as they're gaining the opportunity through equity to both be lifted up together and for the family to be lifted up. So I think it's partly helping men see their own capacity to give up power in some sense, but also to gain something really meaningful, important in return.
I think it's really interesting. I used to talk to my students about the fact that in the United States, that we know that, again, as you look at mothers with children, that those who are primary breadwinners, which is over 40% now in the U.S., right? Mothers with children, over 40% of the primary breadwinners out there, when they're married to a male spouse in particular, those couples make the most money. So if you compare them to where they're co-breadwinners or the male is the primary breadwinner, those are the ones who make the most money out there. And that's kind of telling, right? There's something going on there in that way. Great. Miriam, I want to come back to you. So love to hear, do you have any advice for some of those guys out there your colleagues that want to be male advocates, and as Romy told us with her research, but they're not really sure where to start. It's like, so where do I start? Where do I begin this journey?
Yeah, so I guess my dad always says just start at the beginning, right? Like, take one simple, small step. And I like to tell stories, so I'll tell you a story, and maybe that'll help some folks. So about 10 years ago, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I was working on a project and working really closely with somebody on a pretty important issue. It happened to be a male senior leader, and the project ended. And as a true girl, I will say, I was like, okay, project done. What's next on my list? You know, and that person like just randomly set up time on my calendar for a coffee like a week later. And he spent maybe 15 minutes just asking me, like, what was I interested in? What were some of the career choices I had in mind? Like, you know, what was kind of my plan in life? And it, to be honest, it took me aback a little bit. Not that somebody was asking me those questions, but that someone at his level who didn't really know me, right, someone I was actually working for on a small project, took time to do that. And then unbeknownst to me, you know, so the coffee ended. Again, I went back to my desk, got to get through my checklist. And then unbeknownst to me, of course, I find this out years later, he started sending other people to me, right? Like, other people started scheduling time on my calendar. People started giving me, like, advice that was just really impactful and really helpful. Sometimes it was work-related, right? Like, had me work on a project or whatever. So a couple years ago, I socially saw him, and I was like, you know, that meeting was really important to me. Like, thank you for having that coffee. And he's like, did you notice how many people I sent to you? Right? Like, and he wasn't bragging. He was trying to teach me how to do it for the next person. And if I had to guess in that year, maybe I spent 20 minutes, 25 minutes talking to him, right? It certainly wasn't, you know, every week for hours on end. But boy, did that 15 or 20 minutes really matter a lot to me. So I guess I would say for that baby first step, right? Like, just schedule a coffee with somebody that you think is talented. Especially if it's someone who doesn't see it in themselves yet, right? And just talk to them about what are the options that are available to them. And if they wanted those options, what are some of the things that they could think about? If they're struggling with the balance part, maybe connect them with people who have figured that out. And it doesn't have to be a huge time commitment. It doesn't have to be a huge, significant moment. But boy, did I appreciate that. I know a lot of us in the room have had that over our careers. And it's such a small thing to say to somebody, you know, I see something in you. Do you see it in yourself? So that's kind of what I would advise the unicorns in the room and those outside.
Great. Thank you. And would love to ask more questions here, but I want to take some time here for you to ask questions. I know you've got a lot of burning issues on your mind and questions for this great panel up here. So there's microphones set up out there for you if you want to come on up. And Celeste, you're going to help me manage this? Thank you. I need all the help I can get.
All right, thank you. If you could just, we'll alternate the mics. But there's only one in the center, so you got to line up. All right, you are first.
Hi, I'm John. I guess I'm one of the unicorns you were speaking about. Real quick, my wife makes more than me, and we moved here for her job, so I'll just throw that out there. I probably should have somebody record that so I can send it to her. Earlier in the keynote, there was a point made about you fall to the level of your systems. And then you were in your talk, I was thinking about decision making. So earlier this week, 5 p.m., I'm having a beer with my boss and a VP of another department, all guys, and we're making the decisions. And this has struck me of, do we have a lot of opportunity to take out some of the gender bias in the way decisions are made and the process that we have? And do you have some comments about maybe how we can do that?
Sure. So since I called you the unicorn, welcome. So the answer is yes. There's a lot of decisions that have historically gotten made. I always say a lot of decisions get made on the golf course.
Totally.
Right. And I don't play golf, and I have no interest in it at all. So I absolutely think that there is a opportunity to try to change that. I just try to point it out quite a lot, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I have colleagues, as do some of mine, who will say, well, we're going to go play a round of golf. And I'll say to them, well, you better not be making any strategic decisions because you don't have 50% of us there with you.
Yeah.
And so does it take courage to do that? Yeah, it does. But do I have an accountability and a responsibility to do it? Yeah, I do. Right. So if I want change, I've got to kind of and I will say it does make people stop and think a little bit. Right. But yeah, I think you're dead on. I think there's a lot of decisions, and in particular, people decisions, right? Like opportunity decisions that get made over a beer or golf clubs. I mean, I'm stereotyping highly, but...
Right. Well, so I would also challenge you to be as inclusive as... Right? Because I can tell you, I've been on the other side of that, where I see all my male colleagues head out for a beer or for golf without me, and it feels awful, whether there's a decision being made or not. So how can we make sure that the social activities that relate to work are really inclusive? And if not, I wouldn't do them.
Yeah, fair point.
We had a lot of people in our research who just men who would tell us they just didn't even think to ask.
Yeah.
And so part of it's just, again, right, a little bit of disrupting the status quo here.
Yeah. All right, we're going to try to get as many questions as you can. So name and company, too. Don't forget to introduce yourself.
Okay. Hi, everyone. My name is Heidi, and I'm a vice president at Health Advocate. I wanted to, first of all, acknowledge you all. I came here today very grudgingly, got to be honest. We sponsored a table, and I was thumbs down on the idea of a women's conference. So thank you for changing my mind. And I have a feeling there are a few others of you out there. I grew up through the workplace in an era where I was in sales, I was a high producer, and I never felt gender bias. It might have been there, but I didn't feel like there were any ceilings, and it was never a theme in my professional identity. So as I hear about these issues, I don't want to say not me, but maybe that's where I was. Last week, I heard somebody say something, and it hurt my feelings so deeply because there was an assignment to my younger colleagues who are nursing babies, who are taking work home and working weekends, that because they leave the office at 5 o'clock, perhaps they're not really working to their full potential. So I spoke to a few of my team members, and I asked them about it. And it's really not a question, it's really more of a plea. Those of you who have had the benefit of a successful career without a lot of perceived roadblocks, don't forget that our younger sisters, they think the job is done, but it's not. And it's our job to ask them the question too. As women, we get to ask each other, what happens at 5 o'clock? And the answer is, ladies, daycare closes. Daycare closes at 5 o'clock or 5:30. Yes. And so many of the people who are making business decisions about who's committed to their job are people who have the luxury of somebody else picking the kids up, somebody else shopping for dinner. And I just want to share with all of you that I was that part-time mom. I worked 3 days a week, but I really worked 5 days a week. And nobody gave me credit for it. I didn't ask for it. But if you are one of those people, you need to let your younger colleagues know, whether they're men or women, go home and pick up your kids. I have confidence that you'll get the work done. And it may not get done during conventional hours, but we need to give them permission. And I want to thank you for allowing
me
to
stand
up on my soapbox.
We have 10 minutes left, so I'm going to ask you to really be concise and get through, so we can get everyone through. Thank you.
My name is Oksana Stouch. I work for JP Morgan Chase, Vice President. So I saw this quote the other day, which I tend to agree with, but I wanted to ask your opinion. So the quote said, men are promoted based on their potential. Women are promoted based on their experience. So what do you think?
Yeah, so that comes from a McKinsey research study that was published in 2011. And in my personal opinion, I can't describe how accurate it really felt. I can feel this like visceral red-faced anger watching a less qualified man get the promotion that I knew I deserved repeatedly. And it's awful. That said, here's what I think. I think it's so true, and I don't think it's going to change tomorrow. There are different promotion standards. That's terrible. It's not fair. But I think we all have to, we have the benefit of this knowledge. We have to make use of it and behave differently as a result. So if we know that it's our performance that's going to get us promoted, we have to spend a lot of time showcasing our performance. Women, we talked about this in a session this morning, women are really good at doing stuff. They're not really good at telling everyone what they did. So we have to go out and brag about our achievements and make sure anyone who could potentially be making a promotion decision really knows what we did. And then we can all get promoted. And then when we're all promoted and we're all in senior leadership, then we can even out the promotion standards.
And it's your company, by the way, that has the 35-1 rule. You're familiar with, right? So guys, everybody out there spending 36 minutes a week, 30 minutes out there having coffee, lunch with a woman, spend 5 minutes a week out there talking about her a woman's accomplishments, right? Just what we're talking about. And then 1 minute advocating on her behalf when she's not even in the room.
It's not practiced much in reality, but I know about it.
But it's a great rule.
But you know what? It's a good starting point.
It is.
It's a Where very good start? Starting point.
Thank
36
you.
Minutes a week. Thank you.
I'm Meg M. I'm from GlaxoSmithKline. And I would say, like one of the earlier people, that I don't really feel that I've had been discriminated against. But actually, the area that I've felt most frustration has been being in a room that is half and half and feeling that my voice is not heard in the same way, even if I'm saying a very similar thing as a man. And I just... Even though I, you know, when I saw the thing that talked about allies, I focused on, I go out every day and find allies for my scientific ideas and the projects that I want to do, but I still get in the room and my voice is not heard. So what advice do you have for, you know, for helping get your voice out there when you have ideas that are just as good as the other ones that are being discussed?
I mean, I would just say to continue to amplify your voice, to actually you know, continue to assert it with authority. I want to sort of tie this into the last question, which is around experience and that sort of confidence. I ran for political office, so one of the things and failed, but one of the things that I took away from that was the importance of women stepping into the arena. And so often, if you look at the research around political elections and women, they step back and they wait for people to ask them. So when you ask somebody, why did you run for office? Because somebody asked me to do it. And often they'll say, but I didn't feel like I had enough experience. Whereas men don't wait for somebody to ask, and they also are not necessarily feeling or self-censoring around their experience, but believe in their promise. And so part of this, I do think, is how do we encourage one another? How do we form allies with other women to help encourage us to continue to assert our voice, even when we don't feel heard? And I think to also call out our male allies to say, you're not creating space for us in the conversation, and or I'm not feeling heard. So I think making that transparent as well.
Good question. Next.
Hi, I'm Peg Squire. I'm a group VP at Insight, a biotech company. David, I want to thank you and your colleague for Athena Rising. I read that a few months ago. I was excited to see you be here. It's a terrific book.
Thank you.
One experience that I had resonates with something that you describe in the book. A few years back, I'm going to say a few years so it doesn't implicate any specific company, I was traveling to a meeting with three C-suite colleagues, all men. And one of them talked about the difficulty of having a woman mentee is because it starts rumors about them. So it's not the Me Too thing, it's the getting stories circulated. And you talked about that, and I wonder if you can reflect on that, because I think that is one of the barriers, at least, that I see in my world. Thank you.
Yeah, so I think what she's getting at here, in particular, the perceptions that especially if you're a man and you decide, hey, I'm in, and one of the things I can be doing is I can be mentoring and sponsoring more inclusively, right? So not just people who look like me, in particular women. And the concern there is, because they've seen this in one way or another, that if I suddenly start mentoring this one woman, that people are going to start talking. There's something going on here, right? I give them something to talk about. Other men, as you might remember in the book, that talked about how there were concerns about perceptions by their spouses, by their wives, that suddenly I'm spending all this time with this junior woman at work, what's going on? And so we have to think about, all right, how can we be very transparent and talking about this and what we're doing and why we're doing it, introducing it to others, doing it in public spaces. You know, again, it varies by company and by team out there how the best practices are to do it, but the when you meet, the where you meet, the structure of kind of how do we do our mentoring relationships in particular is really important. And don't mentor one woman. Mentor 20 women, right? Guess what? There won't be anything to talk about.
Excellent. For question, Very good though. Question. Next.
Hi, my name is Amanda Grutz. I work for Merck. I do lab quality assurance. My question is based upon, I've had an experience where I'm a very outspoken person. I don't mind stating my opinion on things. When it comes to situation, there's different reflections of different pools. So my question is when I say something, it may come off as emotional or you're too compassionate. But if the male says it, why is it that they seem that they're taking that boss mentality, that leadership mentality? I would like to know that, like, the difference between the two, is it a verbal, the way I speak? Is it I should say something that a male shouldn't say? I've encountered that, and I just don't understand that, so. Yeah.
Yeah, I wish I had an answer for that.
Yeah.
It's just so frustrating.
Yeah, I don't know how to, I shouldn't even say speak upon that, because I've had the experience where it was sort of me voicing my opinion, and it was taken the wrong way, and it was take a step back. But I feel like, personally, I should take a step forward, not back.
So, but again, I do think the thesis is about open dialogue, courageous conversation. So I think you playing back, hey, I feel like I say things, and you're not interpreting the right way. And because in the world, we're all going to get along better if everybody understands where each other's coming from.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Last question.
I didn't dare want to be first. So Conrad Kelly, I'm at Merck. I'm an aspiring unicorn.
Mm-hmm. No, you are a unicorn.
And I think the word aspiring is important, because part of the issue, I think, what I've observed is that we've crowned too many men allies without the body of evidence to support that they really are allies.
Yeah.
And most of the discussions that I have with women are undoing the bad advice that they were given by other men that kind of perpetrate these ideas that they already believed about themselves. So one of the things I think we need is tools to help women understand, is this person really an ally or not? And to ask certain questions to be able to observe certain behaviors. And the second thing I would say is that most of the inequity in this country is based upon things that are systemic and institutional. As a people leader of multiple teams and large teams, I've never once been asked any questions around diversity or inclusion or my leadership abilities. And so I think until we start incorporating that, even though it's a leadership behavior and you get asked other questions about leadership behaviors in the job interview, this is one of the leadership behaviors that doesn't actually get discussed or go into detail before you move up. And therefore, you have people that can rise to very high ranks in the organization never having to demonstrate their competencies or capabilities around diversity and inclusion.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom.
Guys, I would just say that you're an ally when she says you're an ally. And each day you have to earn your cape.
That's it.
Or your unicorn, right?
Thank you so much for attending this session, and thank you to our wonderful panel.